Well, the world is a dumpster fire. Nothing here makes sense. And you vacillate between crippling fear and constant self-defense. And nothing's right and nothing's good. And you're paralyzed with grief. Don't kill yourself, just have a cup of coffee.
Welcome to Coffee Over Suicide, the dramedy podcast about mental illness and choosing life over death one cup of coffee at a time. I'm your host, Chris Parker Howard. And I just saw my therapist the other day, and we had a pretty interesting conversation. And let me tell you what that was. I came to the conclusion that I do a lot of good things for all of the wrong reasons. And one of those things is the idea of taking care of my body has always been done more or less so I can try to push out as much material, songs, podcasts, short films, poetry, everything that I could possibly get out of myself. Wringing everything dry, getting the marrow out before an early sickness comes on and I'm stuck in a bed with cancer. I didn't even know that I had that belief until we started having a conversation about it. And I realized that that's the reason I do almost everything that I do, is because I want to be able to leave something behind. And I want to experience as many things as I possibly can before I'm stuck in a bed, unable to do anything. Because the idea of dying doesn't really scare me. The idea of getting really sick and ultimately losing my ability to do the things that I care about is what scares me. It scares me a lot. And it makes me run around and push really hard for the next experience, because I don't know when the next one is coming. I feel like this impending sickness is just around the corner. And it's a genuine fear that I didn't even know I had until I had to try and explain to my therapist why I'm constantly pushing to try and do more and more and more. It's not even about workaholicism or anything like that. It's really out of fear. I'm talking to you right now out of fear. And what we're doing right now is a good thing. But the motivation comes from maybe a less than healthy place. And so that's a thing that I'm going to work on. But speaking of health, today on the show, I have got Dr. Joanne Lefebvre Connolly. And we have a really, really fascinating conversation that takes a whole lot of twists and turns. I think you're really going to enjoy this one. So I'm going to go ahead and stop talking so that we can get right into the conversation, because it's pretty dense and there's a lot to absorb from a genuinely thoughtful and brilliant person. I do want to say, if you haven't yet listened to the brand new Randomify podcast, Let's Laugh About Death, with host Tim Rooney. Yours truly was the very first episode. So if you want to go check that out, you can always go to the Randomify Facebook page or just look up Let's Laugh About Death and you'll find it. There I get into a in-depth conversation about stuff that I actually don't talk about a whole lot on this show. Existentialism and spiritualism and all kinds of fun little, woo-woo kind of stuff. It's a real good time. You should definitely check that out. And let them know I sent you if you do that. So, now that the housekeeping is out of the way, let's get into this conversation with Dr. Joanne.
Thank you.
So yeah, let's just start here. Hi, nice to meet you.
Nice meeting you.
Tell me a little bit about your situation. Where are you from? Are you originally from Florida?
I'm French Canadian, but I migrated south because I love the sun.
Yeah,
and the sun's very therapeutic for me. So I picked up my husband on the way in New York. So came from Montreal, 6 hours north of Montreal, worked my way down, met this wonderful man 16 years ago, and we've been journeying through life. And we ended up in Arizona for 11 years, but we missed the, you know, we knew life chapter. We needed water, grass, a horse. so we came back to the East Coast, and we've been in Florida for 3 years. And yeah, I really thrive with the sunshine and nature. That's pretty much my best medication for mental health is being in nature.
Yeah,
with animals and so that's what I do best. So I just go visit up north when it's sunny in the summer for about a couple weeks, and I sit down south otherwise.
So that's quite a difference to go from Canada to Florida.
Yeah, I don't know why I was born there. There must be a reason, but. I just never thrived in the snow winter times when it gets all cold and depressing, and I just want to sleep and wake me up with the bears. So
I mean I know all about it. I'm originally from Michigan, and so we were neighbors.
Yeah, in Detroit. Yeah, no, we're probably in the same town. Somebody broke into my house when I lived there for 1 year when I was training in Detroit Southfield.
Yeah.
It was really depressing. It was the worst place to live.
Ugh, yeah.
Yeah, I'm glad I was just stuck there for 1 year. Yeah.
You know, it's funny the effect that sunshine can have on a human being, and the effect that perpetual gray sky can have on a human being.
It's weird, and people don't realize it until sometimes they never do. But my mother-in-law, so she's from New York, but she moved to Oregon, and now she's got a sun lamp to get some sunshine. And we're trying to obviously tell her to come be with us in Florida.
Yeah.
But right now, you know, she's got her lamp, and it's helping her. But so, not the real thing, but closer. At least she sees a huge impact on her happiness. Yeah.
Yeah. So, so as far as. I mean, it sounds like you've moved around a whole lot. What was the first thing that took you out of your hometown?
School. So undergraduate, then I was an hour away. And then veterinary school, I was 7 hours away. And then I crossed the border. So after I graduated from vet school, I applied through a matching program. So I chose a few places and the... to go do a specialty for a year, specialty training, so that I was matched in Michigan. So it was good for me because obviously I love my mom. I've got, you know, my parents have definitely been my best friends, so I needed to not cut the cord too fast for my mom's sake also. So it was good, you know, Michigan and then New York and then Arizona. I was all grown up and ready to move a little further. And my husband is a very wonderful, colorful person, and he was also, you know, just we live our lives just jump off the cliff when you get to the cliff, because if you don't, then you rot. So we've always been, let's just go for it and see what happens. That's kind of our motto, and it's amazing. You experience the most beautiful things, and it builds characters. You know, what doesn't kill you makes you stronger. So we've been through a lot, but it's been good.
Yeah,
overall, it's been more positive than negative.
You know, and that's funny that you say that. Because I do believe in that whole mantra of what doesn't kill you makes you stronger. But I think that there are cases where it does depend on the individual, because you ultimately have to almost choose to let that make you stronger in a way. If you take my meaning. Because the other way you could go with that is you could obviously take something and let it make you more fearful, let it turn you inward to yourself, let it turn you away from the world and away from possibility, because what you've learned is when you try, you get hurt. And that's not necessarily a healthy lesson to think you're teaching yourself.
No, and, you know, we've always been around animals, and so one of my most important mottos in life is animals are the best teachers, and I see how they go about life, so I try to repeat what I see. You know, I feel like they always, they're very wise, and they are very resilient, so I've worked in a lot of shelters. And when I see these poor animals just still believing in love, believing in happiness, believing in humankind, so, because if you don't, then you just rot and you're going to end up dying. You know, it's going to kill you because your body is just shutting down just like your mind is.
Completely.
And some people choose that route. Some people do choose that route, but that's not who we are. I think even though my husband and I have been through a lot of difficult situations, even in our darkest hours, we've always felt like we want to be happy. You know, we deserve it, and we're going to fight. I mean, we're feisty. We're feisty people, apparently, and animals have always been there in our darkest moments to keep us going.
Yeah.
Definitely feel like animals have saved both of us separately before we got together and since we've been together, and now we're a pack traveling together and helping each other out. And I see it that my closest friends have all been saved by animals. Seriously. Yeah.
Yeah. My wife was a veterinary technician for a number of years before she moved on to scientific pursuits outside of that. So, you know,
she's
funny.
Seen a lot.
And she doesn't really handle it well when, people make, the wrong choices when they go get a dog or something. You know, she's just, why would you get that kind of dog?
I mean, veterinarians and the veterinary profession is the number one profession to commit suicide.
Really?
Now it's a crisis. Yeah, there's articles written about it. And it's, people are more and more talking about it. But, unfortunately, I've known a few people who are no longer with us. Because it gets to you, it just your heart. You know, we're not tough. Like most veterinarians and veterinary technicians, go in it because they love animals and they can't deal with the suffering that they see or the pain that people will, abuse of the animals. So it's really mentally difficult. And I feel like I'm less and less stable mentally as, I spend time. I need to find new tools to help me because as years go by, because I feel more of the pain of the world and I know more, I see more horrific situations. So my mental health is definitely, I need to work at it harder than when I grew up and I was more numb from the world, which was a nice way to be, but it was not meaningful. You know, I just chose to, I want to help where the pain is. I want to turn it into action and try to fix.
Yeah,
so,
absolutely.
But it's difficult. It's still a very raw pain. It's hard to deal with.
Well, and you put yourself into a profession that requires you to keep your heart open, and that's something that I think most people have the luxury of being able to shut off. Is if your empathy is hurting you too much, sometimes with a lot of people. You can just shut it off, but when you're tasked with caring for animals, especially since the difficulty with animals too is that in that sense you're almost a steward of their care because they can't tell you exactly what's going on. You can't necessarily communicate to them what you're going to do to make it better. So it is sort of it does require a whole lot of trust between everybody involved in order to have any kind of a positive outcome. And for an animal that's been abused, I imagine that's got to be really hard on both parties.
And, I'd rather deal with animals than people. I do have more animal friends than people friends, so in a shelter environment. I mean, of course, all in balance. You know, I gave a lot of years, and I never wanted to live to be 100, and I don't think I will because, again, I've, you know, gone through a lot emotionally, which is fine. But so in a shelter environment, it, at least you're, you don't have to fight with any human beings as far as, you know, we're all on the same page. All the workers are on the same page. When you work in a hospital and people come in with requests, like cropping the dog's ears, for example, which I've never done it. I will never do it.
Yeah.
But like declawing, which is another hot topic. I've been out of school for 18 years and I had to do it for my first few jobs because my first few years, otherwise I would have lost my job, and I was not as aware, you know, awake, about the trauma. It's terrible. Like, you never want to, it's a shame that we've done it. But anyway, the time came for me during my journey of awakening and becoming, you know, more just realizing what we're doing, that I had to tell my boss, like, I'm done. And I had to put my own job on the line, and my that was my lifeline, you know, my money to pay the bill, but my heart could not do it anymore. And I had a few technicians coming on my side, and, you know, they didn't want to do it either. And my boss had to really do a major soul searching, you know, what am I going to do? What are the clients going to say? But luckily, it became more in the media that we should stop declining. So a lot of states have supported, you know, we're done. This has become illegal. We're not doing this. So I kept my job, and, you know, we moved on, and we were able to educate people, but some people are still mad and they're still declining as we speak. And we're going to go to find a veterinarian that will be okay with it. But personally, you know, you have to draw your own line of what you can deal with and what you can't, because it's too much otherwise.
Yeah. Especially with when you're being asked to modify an animal in a way that is unnecessary, you know, especially with, you know, like ear cropping on dogs, and, you know, and tail cropping for various reasons. Like, I've got a pit bull, and we absolutely were not going to have her ears or her tail cut. That's just ludicrous to me. Why would you want
it's
less
cosmetic.
Dog?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. No, it's totally cosmetic. It's a status, you know, society status. It's an image. Hey, I'm cool. Look at my dog. You know, it's just a.
Yeah.
I mean, that's what it is. But I don't go there. So of course I can't. You know, no, I'm not a veterinarian that everybody's gonna love, because I'm not gonna do what they want me to do. I'm gonna do what I feel is right for the animal, and then I educate. That's what I try to do, is to educate. And, I mean, usually, you know, it goes well and people know. I try to find the right situation, and I think I attract, you know, most people who think like me and who want me for who I am. So the
thing that you brought up that I find fascinating, I'd like to ask you a little bit about that. When was the first time that you had noticed that mental health was being affected by your job?
So, 12 years ago, so I was out of school 6 years, and our dog Haley needed to go to heaven. I brought the medications home. We were able to euthanize her at home. And then I felt like she was, her legacy to me was to start this in-home euthanasia service. Mm-hmm. And I became more, like, that was my, like, adult, my biggest adult, like, breakdown, like, sadness, sad moment of losing her. And, I started helping people at home, and that shifted my practice into really being, just being there, like using less of my brain, but more of my heart.
Yeah.
For families at home in intimate moments. And I became talking about different things and how just the real deep bond between people and animals that it fed my soul also. And I was able to heal through that by helping others going through the same thing.
Yeah.
And it hit me like a ton of brick. I became vegan like overnight during that period. Also, I had all, because, you know, with the internet too, I guess social media, more images of what's happening, like what am I contributing to in this world. I wanted to help all animals. All animals are my friends. I'm not going to eat some of them and then care for others, you know. So that really hit me hard. And I needed to clean up my whole life of not harming anything. Every step, every action that I take, every single day of my life is going to be loving. I'm saving the insects. Like, I've become a little neurotic for normal people. But to me, it's a survival, complete survival. Like, I need to do this because no life, I shouldn't kill any life. You know, if I'm alive here, every life is valued. And if I can just save a spider that's in the house, I mean, I saved cockroaches. I saved a scorpion that we found in the house, you know, black widow. I mean, I don't care. Like, and I realize that my parents, and again, I don't blame them because their parents were telling them that, oh my God, spiders are going to eat you for, you know, be scared of spiders, kill spiders. And I saw my sister raising her kids. I don't have any children. We can't go there. We love animals. Children would be not for us. But I help my, you know, niece and nephews. And when I saw my little two-year-old niece stepping on this spider, you know, for, you know, 2 minutes and hating the spider and crushing it, and you're so bad and you die, you know, I'm like, oh, my God. So I look at my sister, I'm like, what the hell, you know? Let's fix this. Let's say this, we're not threatened, you know, look at the size of them. So that's kind of what I chose to live my life. So I wrote a book about, you know, I needed to share, and it's healing for me. I need to share. It's really turning my own pain of this world into action and trying to educate others so the world can be a good place, at least a little bit better by the time it's time for me to go.
Yeah, and that's actually a really positive thing to do. You know, a lot of people are not, let's say, actualized enough to say, think about their legacy as a human being in terms of what am I leaving behind that could help people. Not necessarily. I mean, you do hear about people saying, "What am I going to leave behind to be remembered by?" And that's not bad either. But, you know, what am I going to leave behind that could help some people? I think that's very admirable.
Well, and most people who get to that point have gone through a near-death experience. You know, they got so scared of dying that, oh, now they're more aware of they're more grateful that they're alive. And so they see the value and, okay, let's make it count.
Yeah.
But, you know, for me, I mean, I've been around death because of the animals, you know, the in-home euthanasia service. I've helped over 10,000 families. And so I just felt like I've been close to it. And even in our personal life, I don't know, my husband and I've gone through a few things where it seems like death was just watching us. And it's funny now because we're in a very good place mentally and emotionally. But we live on an amazing 4-acre property, and there are 30 or so vultures living with us, you know, in the trees in the forest. So when you say death is watching, it's truly watching. It's right there. They're looking at us like, when are you going to be my next meal?
Yeah.
And it's really helping us stay very humble and very connected that, you know, it could be any day. So, yeah, for us, it's really let's make it count because we don't know what tomorrow is going to bring. But I wish, more people would get to that realization before they're 60 and 70 and almost, you know, maybe it's too late. It's going to be too late for them. They'll die before they can really make an impact.
Yeah. I mean, but it takes a lot of work to get to that place. So I would have to imagine that everything that you've gone through up to the point that you are at right now has been some kind of a struggle and sacrifice to get you where you are right now. You've built the life that you wanted to have, but that doesn't come without, you know, work and sacrifice.
Yeah, I don't know if I would say, I mean, sacrifice or just, it depends on how you look at life. If you look at a challenge as, okay, I'm going to grow through this. So it's not as painful. You know, and that's the way I feel like my husband and I have been, just for some reason, looking at life as, okay, there's a roadblock here, but we're going to get over it. And having that just, I don't know, that fire inside And we've learned to believe in ourselves. We've learned, you know, people let you down. You learn to love yourself, and you realize that you have to be your biggest fan. Mm-hmm. So that's really, it's a really great journey to be on. You want to grow, so you kind of embrace the pain or the challenge as they come, and you go with the flow. And that's what animals do best, you know. They just go with the flow, and we've learned to be extremely flexible. And that's been really helpful. Just to, you know, you have a plan, but you need to keep it really fluid, because the best things that have happened to us were not planned. You know, we had an idea, but then, oh my God, you know, this happened out of nowhere. And instead of being afraid of a new door that was opening that we were not planning on, we just went for it and jumped off the cliff. And luckily, you know, you realize that your wings are there. They appear when you meet them.
Yeah.
But and then you gain momentum.
I mean, all of that is extremely inspiring. You know, I'm always curious how people arrive at that. Were you always pretty driven?
No, I was a fearful child. I had an older sister that dug the path for me as far as just going to school. Mm-hmm. So luckily I had her as my, she was my anchor. Like, I would know where she is in the school. We're at the same school, or she would play basketball. So I ended up playing basketball, so I wouldn't be too far from her. But, then my dad, and that's more of my mom's, personality of just being careful. But on the other hand, so my other genetic baggage came from my dad, who's an amazing free spirit traveler of the world, and he's the daredevil. So he's always told me, wherever you want to go, I'll go visit you. And he's always done it. He's always come through everywhere I moved. He's always been there to say, okay, I'm coming now next month. So I've always been really close. And as my mom would be a little bit more, oh my God, you're going to the United States by yourself. And I got a first cell phone then, because, you know, before that, you didn't need anything. That was years ago, no phone, no car. So sure. I moved to the States with a new phone, a new car, and here I am. And I didn't even speak English that well, because I spoke French. But I was curious. I think the curiosity of life, that's been my biggest strength growing up. I was curious. And I was in love with the world, and I wanted to see. And my dad would tell me stories about his travels. And so I wanted to go see for myself. And I've always been surrounded by a lot of loving people. So the strangers I would meet, luckily, they didn't try to kill me. So I'm lucky. When I look back, I could have been in trouble many times. But somehow, I managed to slip through the cracks many times, and I had a very easy, I mean, I had to, you know, make my own efforts of learning and fitting in and all that, but I was supported. I've always felt supported, so I did gain momentum. And finally, when I met my husband, he took me to a whole other level, because he had lived across country, both, you know, New York, California, Florida. And I thought our life was set in Arizona. We were there for 11 years.
Yeah.
But we became really out of balance. I was way overworked, and I couldn't say no. You know, my home euthanasia service, which was the biggest gift at first, became my biggest challenge of, now I'm prisoner of this service because I'm working 7 days a week. We had no life together, and my husband helped me and saved my life, you know, and said, okay, yeah. Well, you're going to decide, this is not good for us. You know, it's going to all kill us. You're almost a guy. I had almost had a car accident a couple times. I knew I was completely out of juice, out of sleep. And he said, you know, I want to go by the ocean. Let's start looking, and you have to decide if you're going to stay or if you're going to come with me. And I couldn't believe that was definitely one of the hardest decisions in my life.
That's a pretty heavy ultimatum.
I can't believe I'm going to give up. Well, I mean, you know, if we had no choice. We were there, you know, and we had discussed this over a period of time, but I knew he was dying there, and I could see how I was dying, and it was not going to be good. We had many warnings. You know how the signs of guidance or synchronicities in life, and things happen, and if you don't listen, harder signs, harder warnings from the universe happen, you know? And So I knew all the signs were there, but my heart was so, I couldn't say no. My love for the animals and those families, and I felt like they made me feel like I was the only veterinarian who could help. And my husband kept saying, come on, there's plenty of veterinarians, you know, be selfish. We need you as a mother, as a spouse, our animals. We need to regroup here. This is not working for us. And I said, yes, you're right. And I had to grieve. You know, that was the end of a life chapter. I had to close it myself. Otherwise, life was going to close it for me. And so yeah. I managed to say, okay, I can, you know, I love my husband. He's a wonderful person. We need to go. We need to save our own selves. So we did 3 years ago, and we moved across country with honestly no job lined up. We just knew we needed to save our souls. And we had a friend in Florida. We had looked at California because we really loved California, but everything was pushing us towards Florida. And so we had a good friend who facilitated us finding a good place in northern Florida. We moved to that house. We started finding pennies everywhere. Just like, I don't know. I mean, where did it come from? You know,
yeah.
somebody, the universe is telling us, you'll be fine. You know, good job. You saved your life. Now you can regroup and find, you know, find work, and you'll be able to pay the bills. Here are a few pennies to keep you motivated. And it's been amazing. You know, it's been the best thing. So I do think my husband has really definitely helped me take it to a whole other level of let's live now because tomorrow might be too late.
Yeah. I mean, that's a pretty powerful thing to know that your future happiness depends on jumping away from a life that you've built that's, you know, yeah. for all intents and purposes, been very successful for you and worked out very well for you. But again, that takes an amount of self-awareness and understanding and willingness to listen to those around you that you care about to be able to take that and say, I'm going to, in a very healthy way, back myself out of this and say goodbye to it in favor of something new, because that's incredibly hard. A lot of people don't handle change very well.
I've paid attention to, I really see life as a, like a book, you know, a series of chapters. And I've seen other people hitting the end of the chapter and resisting it. And I realized that. Luckily, I realized that, okay, this is happening. I probably won't die. It's probably not my last chapter, although it feels like I'm just completely destroying my life, you know, because yes, it was the biggest blessing and the service was amazing. I mean, my God, we had reached the top of that mountain. And if you stay at the top, then you can't climb any higher and you just start stagnating. So yeah, I'm so grateful, but I was scared. Of course, it was crazy. And that's what I told myself. I'm like, okay, we might be crazy here, but that's still, I love this man so much and I love our animals, and I felt guilt of not being home enough. And I felt tremendous amount of guilt because you can't help everybody. You can't split yourself and be home taking care of your family and be out there helping all these animals. So I knew I was out of balance. That's kind of, you know, my husband grew up in New York, so he's had to reinvent himself a few times, and he's a few years older, so he had definitely some wisdom that I didn't have. He's a singer, songwriter. He's a very old soul.
Nice.
So I've learned a lot from him and living to the fullest. That's what he stands for, and fighting for his happiness. So, you know, we're like, you know, if we're crazy, that's fine. Let's just embrace it and try the best we can here. And it's been wonderful.
Yeah.
That can be
a difficult thing for you to learn about yourself, though, as well, is the boundary of how much of yourself do you give away and how much do you keep and what's left for the people in your life? Like, you know, what's left for your husband when you get home? You know, when you're, and likewise, like what's left for yourself when you get home after being out in the world and giving so much of yourself so fully to so many people and putting yourself into very emotional spaces. It's a thing that, to a very lesser degree, I had to learn when I started having conversations with people about these topics, because I would find that I would have people rattling around inside me for days after they would leave. And because I just didn't know how to process, you know, the depth of the emotional thing that I had gone through with them. And I realized, you know, I got to do something about this or it's going to tear me apart. So how did you learn to compartmentalize all of that emotional stuff? What do you do to ground that out?
I spend a lot of time in nature and with my animals. That's truly, like I said at the beginning, my best medication to stay zen and balanced. And I've learned to really figure out or feel where my place is, because it's not my job to save the whole world, and it's not your job to save the whole world, but we think it is. You know, we want it to be. We feel like if I work 24 hours a day, I'm gonna fix this world, you know?
Yeah.
But you won't. So I've reached that point of where I had nothing left to give. And yes, it's so the guilt of, and I felt bad about myself because I'm a good person and I want to be able to give to the people and the animal that have supported me the most, you know, my closest family and my animals before they die themselves, because I would feel terrible, you know? So balance is the most important word, I think, in the, to focus on. And it's a lifelong struggle, and I know I will struggle with it, but I'm officially the most balanced I've been. But it's hard, so now I'm better at when somebody calls, or depending on what the situation is, I really filter within my own body. Like my, you know, our intuition gets stronger, and you know inside if it's your place or not. So when it's my place, I embrace it. When I know it's not my place to help, I can refer to someone else, and obviously I always send my loving thoughts and the most love I can to help somebody go through a crisis. But, you know, luckily there are emergency rooms that are open 24 hours, and you have to keep balance. And I work on it every day, but I've finally come to the place where no matter what happens in my life, what's the most important is, me, my sanity. Like my dad tells me, you won't help anybody if you're in a hospital bed. So stay healthy, take care of yourself, and take care of your family, because they've supported me through so much.
Yeah.
That my husband is definitely my soulmate, my best friend, my partner in crime. You know, we fight together we try to make the world a better place, and we support each other to the fullest. But we need to hide in the cave also to regroup and just be together and enjoy each other before we get all old and we go, you know? So we're very aware of that.
So, I mean, the sound of it, you've got an incredible support system that's helped you keep momentum anytime something got going for you.
I have the best mother-in-law in the world. I definitely think I do. I have, my mom is amazing, and she's been, our parents have truly been, extremely supportive. So we call them when we need to, you know, but between my husband and I, we've gone through a lot, and a lot of people would have walked, separate ways. But we've always seen the good in the other person.
Yeah.
And we've always seen the potential, and we've always known that, okay, we can do this, you know. And when you see that somebody's trying hard to grow, and that's what he saw in me, and I'm glad he didn't give up on me. He also, he knew, you know, he loved me so much. And that's, you know, a few times when we're fighting and it's like, God, I wish I didn't love you so much. You know, it would be easier. Let's just walk our separate ways. But we're both so grateful that we've managed to get through everything we have, because love is really what matters. And when you find your best friend, you can really lift mountains. And we're trying. We're climbing the tallest mountains, and we're continuing to fight the good fight to make this world a little less crazy, hopefully.
Yeah. And one of the big things about that, I wanted to ask you about this, because I find it fascinating. I think it's an idea that has yet to really take hold in a mainstream way, but it's definitely coming. And that is what you said about the in-home euthanasia. Can you talk to me a little bit about that?
So it's definitely not easy to, when you start offering the service, you want to try to be as available as possible.
Yeah.
So luckily, after I left Arizona, now there are like 10, at least 10 veterinarians who are offering the service because they saw the need, but they also saw how much it would feed their soul. You know, it feels so good to help and go to people's homes and keep the animals comfortable. And you have the whole family can be there with our people, grandparents, your cousins, anybody, friends, anybody who wants to be there. Doggy parties, you know, some families would invite the doggies' friends and eating ice creams and just celebration of life in general.
Yeah.
So it's really great, but it's also, you have to have a very flexible personality because when is the right time to euthanize? Often you can't plan it. For 99% of the families, it can't be planned to the exact day. You know, you'll know the day before, you'll know a couple days before. Often it's, hey, can you come today? Because he's letting go now. Like he's done. He's showing us the signs and he's given up. So
yeah.
It's very difficult. I have a very flexible personality from, I was born this way. I've never liked routine. I think routine I find boring. So I had the right personality to jump into this and just be called. And you go one way, then you have to go the other way. And you have to change your schedule like 10 times during the day.
Yeah.
So it's not easy, but veterinarians, they need to, they see the need and they love to how good it makes them feel. So, and there's a shortage of veterinarian, even there's so many animals in this world. So there's not enough veterinarians to help just even in the hospitals. So let alone, you know, it's taking much more time to drive to people's homes. You can't be as efficient. So it's a huge need, but we do need more veterinarians on all levels, and animals are the best therapists, I find. So I'm grateful that there are more animals in people's lives. But yeah, it's a big challenge. We do need more veterinarians, and veterinarians need to be able to keep their mental health, to keep that balance of helping and not just completely being out of energy. So it's a big challenge as a profession, for sure.
Well, and it takes such a such a personal situation that anyone's going to go through, as such a delicate situation, and it frames it in a much more compassionate and understanding context, I would think.
Yeah, you take your time, you're at home, some people will play their song, will play piano, guitar. Again, it's amazing when what the rest of the pack, the other animals in the household, how much they want to be involved. I went to someone's home twice to help with two dogs, and both times they have this little rabbit, and both times the rabbit would sit by the sick one, and it was so precious. It's just, it brings you back to the magic of life and how much in tune the animals are with what's going on. It's beautiful. I mean, I wish everybody would be able to live it, to experience it, but even more, I wish people could have access to euthanasia at home, because we're all in the same boat, and when quality of life is no longer a possibility, and the patient, whether it's an animal or a human, is suffering, and often sacrificing for his loved one, staying alive in spite of, you know, like I saw my grandparents, you know, it was really sad, because my grandpa had 11 children, and he was ready to go, and he had a heart attack, and he could have just gone. And 11 children, you know, later started arguing, and no, we're not ready. So they ended up taking him to heart surgery. He lived another 7 years in a lot of pain, and there was no quality of life. So his exit door, he missed it. You know, he missed it to help the family to deal with his own passing. So we need to talk about that. And we need to be able to focus our care on the patient because what's worse than dying is suffering. When the soul is ready to go, we need to facilitate that. And we can do it with the animals, and we need to do it with people.
Yeah. I mean, it does become a complicated conversation. You know, there are so many levels to all of this, especially when you start talking about the idea of, you know, helping someone of a human being crossing over to the other side and you know, shuffling off the mortal coil. You know, it is a complicated conversation, because even more than people have, this idea of, I mean, we've all sort of as a society come around to the idea that we have to do what's best for our animals, and what's best for our animals is to let them go mercifully. But yet, when we have human beings who are actually, elderly or dying of a terminal disease, you know, and they can tell you with, you know, sound mind and body, where they are and what's going on, and that they are, you know, interested in getting rid of the pain, there are a lot of resistance points to that. And I guess I understand it, but at the same time, it's a complicated conversation, but I think it's one that should be had. How do you manage the quality of life for people? And at what point do we have the right to tell people, you know what, we're going to take control of this for you since you can't be trusted with it? It's a really, really hard conversation.
So I do find it simple because of what I've been through and all these years of animal teaching me.
Sure.
So I talk about it a lot in the book. I mean, the book I wrote, a lot of it has to do with end-of-life care, and I address the situation with people and how can we help our people based on the animal model, because we're all the same. We're all the same.
Yeah.
So why is the resistance?
I mean, we're mammals.
Fear. Yeah. Yes. I mean, again, we all have a body that's going to expire at some point. So here's the thing. Why is there resistance? It's because there is fear of unknown. You know, people have not experienced what I have experienced. And when you decide to look at it, you know, look at death in the face and not be afraid, and then educate yourself and read my book and let's talk about it, then you take fear out of the equation and you realize how much the focus needs to be on not suffering. And all the signs become clear and again, we're not treating a disease. We're treating a patient, and I'm really clear on that because I find that that's one big improvement we need to make in medicine.
Yeah.
You can have 100 people with cancer or 100 people with kidney failure. Every single one of them will have a tailored plan of treatment plan, passing away plan. You know, it all has to do with the personality of the person, his life purpose, any dreams, any synchronicities. I mean, dreams are so powerful. They guide us. They've guided me in euthanizing my horse. A lot of families I have helped share with me those intimate dreams, or, you know, somebody's loved one is in heaven, sends them a sign from the other side, like they smell the pipe or the perfume of that loved one that's been dead. You know, those things are so powerful in helping us make decisions so we can really honor the dignity of the person who's sick, the patient who's sick. So there is no, people are afraid, oh, if it's legal, everybody will want to be euthanized. Well, no, we don't euthanize all animals.
Right.
Most of us want to live, but the option is there. So when it's needed, we don't suffer.
Yeah.
We're keeping the dignity, preserving really the essence of the dignity of the person. So then that's very simple. It's extremely simple. And I hope that that is truly my biggest, I find my biggest battle, like where I'm the most passionate about making a difference in this life, on earth, is to help people not suffer anymore. When they're ready to go, we need to help them go.
Yeah. You know, and that's an interesting point that you make too, about it being a lot more simple. I think that you're right, overall. I think the thing that I was attempting to say, maybe inelegantly, was that I think that it's a difficult conversation to have when people are so full of their own biases and fears. And it really do think is a matter of people having to confront their own mortality and their own fears. Because I'll tell you, I have sat in a room with a loved one while they were, you know, in a coma that was not going to come out. They were not going to come out of. I've been in the room with someone who was just old and in pain and going slowly and painfully. And I have thought to myself in those moments, yeah, that's what this would be for. Like, let's let them have some form of rest. They're on their way there already. It really is a matter of taking away pain in the end. When they're at the end of their life, it's different when you're in, say, the beginning of your life or the middle of your life. You have a lot more life to go. And all of those things. There may be things about your existence that you want to die. There may be things about your situation that you want to be gone. But those are all things that can be changed, can likely be counseled through, etc. It's not the same thing as end-of-life care. It's not the same thing. So, like you said, the idea of saying, well, everyone would just want to go do it, well, that's ludicrous. We wouldn't allow just everyone to go through it.
It would definitely come with a lot of counseling and medical professionals, just like we're doing with the animals. You know, we don't euthanize everybody who wants when people come in and they feel like they want to have their pets euthanized. Most veterinarians that I know and myself, we make sure we feel okay with this decision. And not all situations are black or white.
Yeah.
Obviously, some easy ones. You know, when you have behavioral issues or, you know, when there's hope for improvement, so same like you're saying with people, you know, teenager, midlife crisis, you know, going through a bad spell. And so it's not always, there's a lot of gray zones that require more conversation and definitely more assessment.
For sure. But is a conversation that's worth having.
Yeah, exactly. And just looking at the patient and assessing the whole life, looking at their life from all angles and see how we can help. Because all of us, I think everybody suffers from some mental illness because it's difficult. Even if you have the best life possible, it's a difficult journey to come here, incarnate, grow. You're going to end up with bumps in the road, challenges, and we all need a support system. We all need to tell ourselves to shut up inside, you know, tell our evil voice inside to just, okay, you know, get out of here and leave me alone and I'm going to be happy. You know, so we always have to check in and keep encouraging ourselves. But I've seen some children, unfortunately, who were at the end of their life. And was it because they came here for a very short time to enlighten, to teach other people, to teach their families? Like, you know, there's a life purpose for everyone. But when a child is very sick and there is no hope, whether it's cancer, or I had a good friend of mine who I talk about in the book, and her child was born with a very severe heart disease. And he died at a young age. He was 16 or so, I believe. And it was the hardest thing she had to do to help him, because he didn't die suddenly either. He was hooked up on different things. But he also was able to tell his mom, "Mom, I love you, but it's time now. I'm ready to go." So being able to be selfless, I'm getting chills all over my body, because of course it's painful. It's painful to look at your child and say, "Oh my God, I can't believe I have to let you go." But your suffering, what is your suffering compared to his suffering? You know, that's what I tell people. You might think you're in pain, but your animal is in real, much greater pain. You know, can't even get up. That's how much pain he's in. Your pain is emotional. You're going to miss him. Of course, it's the end of a big life chapter, but we still need to be selfless in focusing on what the patient needs from us to do, and then grandson with that dignity and loving gift of ending suffering and being free.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I mean, all of that is incredibly, incredibly thought-provoking. There's so much to unpack in all of that. But, you know, we as human beings, we've kind of conditioned ourselves almost in a way where death is something that we're not really comfortable addressing as a topic of discussion until it has to be discussed, when it should really be a topic of discussion, you know, the whole time. We should just be aware that, you know, the electric meat that we're driving around is going to expire at some point. And it may expire because it aged out. If you're lucky, that's how it expires. But it might expire because of an accident. You know, you could get hit by a bus. You could get hit by cancer. You know, likely you're going to get hit by cancer. But you know, it's a conversation that needs to be had, because it's not necessarily about death exactly. It's about living your life in such a way that it has a quality, and that you feel like you've done it. You've lived it, you've been in it, and because you had a recognition that it wasn't always going to be yours. Does that make sense?
Absolutely, absolutely. And the more we talk about it, the less afraid we are of it, and the more prepared we are. So when something happens, like an accident, it's not a shock, oh my God, we're numb, because we the more we talk about it, if something happens, we are not in shock. We are able to process. We are able to stay grounded and level-headed to be able to say, okay, this is what happened. How is my loved one feeling? What kind of decision do I have to make? Are we fighting for quality of life, or are we changing gear and going towards quality of death?
Yeah.
So absolutely. The more we talk about it, the better prepared we are. And we're all going to die, let's face it. We just need to realize that and make peace with it. Yes, we're all going to leave this earth. And how much dignity? That's the question, and that's my focus. I just want everybody to pass with the dignity that they deserve, because we deserve it.
Yeah. Well, thanks for talking to me. This has been amazing.
You're welcome. Very grateful. And yes, we could have this conversation for years, and that's what it needs to be. It needs to be the journey. The journey of living until it becomes a journey of dying.
Absolutely.
And you end up being just grateful for every single moment. And one of my other mottos that I like is live each day like it's your first day on earth, and also like it's your last day.
Oh, I love that. That's amazing. Thank you so much.
You're very welcome.
Oh, I cannot thank her enough for coming in here and lending her expertise and knowledge and just generally being wonderful and open and willing to talk. It's always wonderful when people are willing to talk. If you want to find out more, you certainly can. Go to Amazon and look for her book, Animal Teachings, From Haley's Angels Method. You'll find it also in French. If you want to support this show, you can do that now for free just by going to radiopublic.com and searching for Coffee Over Suicide. Every time you listen through the Radio Public website or app, I get a little bit of a kickback. It is the only way currently I can keep the lights on in here, and I like the lights on. And until next week, don't kill yourself out there.